No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So welcome to the show. And unfortunately, Marilia can't be with us, but we have a very special guest today. We have Dr. Samuel Perry. Dr. Perry is an award-winning scholar and teacher. He is among the nation's leading experts on conservative Christianity in American politics, along with numerous articles published in leading academic journals. Dr. Perry has also authored or co-authored four books. The latest, which is coming out shortly, is called The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. We hope to talk to him about that book and you know, other issues. This is very important stuff that he's working on. Dr. Perry, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. This will be fun.
Yeah, it will be fun. And you know, let me start out by telling you where I stand, because I'm so confused by all this. You know, the first guy I worked for in politics was Jimmy Carter. Very religious guy. I'm a religious guy, to be honest with you. Very religious guy. But somehow the right-wing Republicans had co-opted us on the issue of religion. All of a sudden, you know, a guy named Jerry Falwell, who I'm sure you're familiar with, came, you know, the rise of him and his political group and Liberty University and all that stuff. It seemed all of a sudden that to be a Democrat was to be unchristian. And I'm not quite sure how that happened. And do you think that's still the case? Have liberals somehow been, have they co-opted God somehow so that liberals are now seen as unchristian?
That has absolutely become more the case in the past few decades. So around the 1970s, we can document this statistically with something called the General Social Survey. Around the 1970s, let's just say white evangelicals, you were basically the same percentage of Democrats and Republicans were white evangelical and white Christian. Doesn't mean they're necessarily religious, but you basically have the same kinds of numbers. And so over the past few decades, though, because of political sorting, you have had the Republican Party has become increasingly disproportionately white, but increasingly conservative Christian, especially evangelical. About 4 in 10 Republicans are evangelical, and about 8 in 10 are white Christians. Wow. That doesn't mean there are no Christians and no religious people in the Democrats, but they're more diverse. So the Democratic Party is filled with African American Protestants and mainline Protestants and more progressive Catholics, but they're also full of a larger percentage of secular Americans who feel like the Democratic Party is the only place where they can be represented or have their voices heard. And so because of greater diversity within the Democratic Party, Republicans are able to leverage this argument, which is not an accurate argument, but they're able to leverage this argument that the Republican Party is the party for deeply religious or religiously conservative Americans.
Well, you know, as you have people, it seems to me this group of people is becoming even more conservative and more conservative. As that goes on, It seems to me they see a lot of Republicans as not Christian enough. Do you think that there'll be a movement to start a third party, like a nationalist Christian party, which might coalesce a lot of these disenfranchised groups? Do you think that's a potential down the road?
Oh, that's a good question. I do think, I mean, within the last 6 or 7 years, I can't tell you the number of people that I've talked to that say around the country that are concerned Christians, that they may be theologically conservative Christians, but they're not far right politically. And they feel politically homeless. That is the term that they use, politically homeless. They feel like the Republican Party has completely gone off to the right in a very reactionary, white nationalist kind of direction, even anti-democratic in some ways. But they also feel uncomfortable in the Democratic Party because they say they're pro-lifers, or they are, you know, uncomfortable with more government involvement, say in economic issues. They're scared of socialism or some kind of, you know, some kind of boogeyman that they have kind of got in their mind that the Democrats want to institute. And so I think a third party, they often communicate like, hey, wouldn't it be great if we had some kind of other option other than where we feel like these two are going. In the end, though, they end up going with what they are told is the most important issue, and that's often abortion or Supreme Court justices or religious liberty. And so they end up voting Republican, even though oftentimes they do hold their noses and have to do that. So that is a large percentage of people that I'm talking to. But then you've got others that have really bought into the Republican Party line. They are partisans, and they have mingled their committed Christianity with far-right politics. And that's really what we're talking about with, say, white Christian nationalism.
Well, let me ask you, has the fact that abortion, for example, has become a litmus test for both sides, right? It's a litmus test in the women's movement. It's a litmus test for people to be involved in the women's movement, that you have to stand up for a woman's right to choose. And, of course, in the Republican Party, it's become a litmus test for being conservative, being a conservative. Has that hurt us as liberals that we've taken this issue and embraced it so, you know, and made it so important?
You know, I would say on the right, it is used as the abortion issue is not something that we can point to this statistically. Abortion is not something that drives people to the polls. And when we ask Americans to rank on various surveys, when we ask them to rank or indicate what they felt like was the most important issue in whatever election, presidential election 2016, 2020, they very rarely say abortion. Even evangelicals are more likely to say the economy or immigration or healthcare. Mm-hmm. Or something like that. Abortion may be higher than, say, for like progressives, but even among evangelicals, it's not the highest thing, or Catholics even. What that suggests is that the abortion issue is often used as this symbolic boundary. Just like you're saying, it kind of identifies you politically. Mm-hmm. But it also, if you are on the right, it also becomes a strategic thing that you can throw down. So, for example, many evangelicals, may have wanted to say vote for Trump or vote for Trump's kind of policies, but those things sound ugly. And Trump himself was a big bully, right? and still is. And so it sounds unchristian to say that you like Trump and that you like his policies and you like his way of doing things. But you can always point to abortion, right? If that is by tribal reputation, or if that is by your kind of group reputation and the thing that you feel like indicates that you are, like you said, conservative or liberal, you can always point to abortion and say, hey, well, at least he's the pro-life president. And so that justifies you voting for anybody. You could vote for the devil himself as long as he promised he would support pro-life policies. And you would be able to basically just kind of, you know, enjoy the rest of everything that he would promote. On the left, though, it's kind of interesting. So I do think rhetorically I'm not making a statement about whether or not the Democrats ought to back away from their pro-choice stance. That really is not my point here. But my broader point is that you could see the difference in the way Obama approached the abortion issue versus the way Hillary approached the abortion issue. And Obama really came at it from the standpoint of almost apologetically pro-choice, right? Like he said on the front end, like, hey, abortion is something that we would like to just see reduced, period. And the way we're going to do it is by, you know, say, education and, you know, employment opportunities, and not by outlawing it, but by doing this. And so he basically said, hey, you know, I'm not for abortion. We should all want to reduce this because it's a sad thing, but let's reduce it this way. Hillary Clinton, I think, made a much stronger stance about women's right to choose and that she was for that. And I think those on the right, especially the religious right, were able to point to her and say, look at that. Look how proud she is. Look how pro-abortion she is. And I think in a way, Obama was able to sidestep that more effectively. So in some ways, the abortion thing does come back to, rhetorically be used against Democrats in that way.
Yeah. And, you know, that's why I asked the question. I've got to tell you that when I was campaigning in Minnesota one time for John Kerry, actually, I had a right-wing Christian come up to me and say, I can't vote for your candidate because he's pro-abortion. And I said, and that startled me. I said, nobody's pro-abortion. No, nobody's out there saying, let's figure out ways to get more abortions, you know. But I could see that was definitely, you know, the attitude they had. Let me ask you, and this goes back to the comment you made about President Trump. How do Christians conflate the principles of Christianity with this militancy and violence and supporting people like Trump? I can tell you that my mother was a real strong Republican, but after he made the comments he made about women, you know, grabbing women, she wouldn't have voted for him. You know, that would have done it for her. She wouldn't have voted for him. How do they do that? Donald Trump seems to me to be, in principle, one of the least Christian people, you know, in America. So how do they conflate those issues? Do you know?
Yeah. So I think, and this is where I think we get into the difference between, say, Christianity theologically and white Christian nationalism as a political ideology. Christianity, I mean, I think is something that's on its own. It's a belief about, you know, the Bible. It's about the belief about Jesus, and it's certain religious practices. And so, as a religion scholar, I like to distinguish. There are certainly some overlap, or like extreme overlap. People who endorse white Christian nationalism are often Christians, but it doesn't mean that they're one and the same. And Christian nationalism as an ideology is, I think, what we are seeing far more prevalent on the right, on the political right today. And what that means, and how we mean it in our books and all the studies that we're doing, is an ideology that people like us, and when I say people like us, I mean white, native-born, conservative Christians, founded this nation. This nation was made prosperous by people like us, and it really should privilege people like us. And our identities are preferences in the policies, in our sacred symbols, all of those things. And so, looked at it from that perspective, Donald Trump is exactly what you want, because he's a guy who's going to fight for you. He is a guy in 2016 and in 2020, he repeatedly, and I have quote after quote after quote of Donald Trump saying that he will fight for committed Christians. Speaking to evangelical audiences or conservative Christian audiences, he said Christianity will have power. You don't need anybody else. You know, you're going to have somebody representing you very, very well. And he talked to audiences and talked about how Christianity is under siege and it's under attack. He didn't mean the theology of Christianity. He meant people like us. He meant white, conservative, native-born Christians who are the rightful leaders of this country. And so Donald Trump, Tony Perkins, you know, this pundit, you know Tony Perkins. So Tony Perkins, Politico in 2018, I think he summed it up the best. The author of this Politico article asked him, hey, why did you give Trump a mulligan for the Stormy Daniels thing? For, you know, paying, that seems so inconsistent with a Christian witness. And Tony Perkins said, you know, we were willing to give him a mulligan because we got tired of being pushed around by Obama and all of his leftists. And we were glad that somebody was on the playground who was willing to punch the bully. That's exactly what they want. So they want that is and that is who Trump represents. He is not necessarily the embodiment of everything that it is to be Christ-like or a Christian, but they don't want that anyway. They want somebody who is going to fight for their values. We say it like this in the book. You know, they could have had Pence when Trump was impeached, but they didn't want to have Pence because they don't want somebody who fights like a Christian. They want somebody who fights for Christians. There's a big difference between those two.
Absolutely. And how important do you think it is that they have a legitimate claim as Christians to a lot of the symbolism that's out there in America? I mean, America was founded by Christians. It was a lot of the symbols, I don't care if it's In God We Trust on our money or, you know, the way our court system is set up, or many parts of the Constitution refer to Christianity. Thomas Jefferson was a biblical scholar. Does that help them a lot? Does that give them a lot of legitimacy that they can claim, as you just pointed out, that they founded the country, that they built the country? They have all those symbols, and how important is that, you know, now that we find ourselves tearing down some of the symbols of racism, for example, from the Civil War, you know, we're pulling down statues of Robert E. Lee. So how important is this symbolism, do you think?
Yeah, so, you know, this is certainly one of the symbols that are all over the country, and all of our monuments are certainly one example of something that they could point to, that people on the right and Christian nationalists especially can point to and say, you know, how can you argue that our nation is a Christian nation when we see Bible verses and we see references to God or In God We Trust? It's on our money, it's on our capital, you know, it's all on all these things. And historically, we've had things like the Ten Commandments in courthouses, and for a long time we had Bible and prayer in public schools until the 1960s. And I don't mean we've always had Bible and prayer in public schools, but I mean teacher instituted or teacher led Bible and prayer, mandatory, that kind of thing. But I also think this is a faulty understanding of history, though, if they point to the past and say, hey, we have until the past 70 years, we were a Christian country and we always knew that we were. I really think that's flattening history a little bit too much. And we talk about this in the book, you know, we have always had debate about what kind of nation that we would be. Thomas Jefferson, as you mentioned, is a great example of that. Like, Thomas Jefferson was a biblical scholar. He knew a lot about Christianity. And yet, you talk about somebody who is promoting disestablishment, or James Madison, in terms of wanting the church and the state to be separate. That's who we get the quote from, Thomas Jefferson, you know, the separation of church and state. And so it's one thing to say that a majority of people in our country have been Christian, and in some ways our country has at times privileged Christianity. It's another thing to say that that is consistent with our Constitution or our founding documents or even our founding ideals of separation of church and state, of no religious tests, and that kind of thing. So the issue is debatable. We have a complex history with religion. And anybody who tells you, I like John Fia, who is a professor, history professor at Messiah College, and he's written on this. You know, his answer to the question, are we a Christian nation or were we founded as a Christian nation? His answer is always, it's complicated. and it really is. We have a complicated past. With Christianity, but I would argue, and I think many Americans are in agreement. In fact, the majority of Americans agree that the separation of church and state is a good thing, and that it is something that protects both our nation and religion. It protects both Christianity and our country.
Well, you know, it is a founding principle that they always seem to forget. You know, they always seem to forget that, and you know. My co-host, let me read you a question because I think this is very important. She writes that oppressed people are not just disenfranchised, but they're people who have lost status and see themselves as worse off in the social order. So her question is, do socially disenfranchised people, are they also biologically and psychologically compromised? And has there been much study on this? You know, I certainly know as a kid, I'm much older than you, but everything in public school, I was in public school, we said the Lord's Prayer. We celebrated right. Christmas, but we celebrated Christmas and Easter. We had Christmas break, Easter break. Nobody ever celebrated Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or, you know, or any other. It was, you know, kind of de facto the official religion of America. And in my neighborhood, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. So, you know, only Catholics were Christians as far as they were concerned. But so is that what's going on with a lot of these people? It's not so much the religion as a loss in status that they're no longer, you know, that they see their control of the, you know, that they're losing control of things.
Right, right. So it's a both and, right? Like, so this has to do with, it certainly has to do with Christianity, its Christian language, Christian symbolism, and oftentimes this is wrapped up in Christian identity and America's Christian heritage, or at least the idea of America's Christian founding, and the prevalence of those kinds of sacred symbols and identities. But because of what's taken place within the last few decades, Christianity is wrapped up with all of these other identities. So political scientist Liliana Mason, she talks about how what's taken place over the last few decades is what she calls identity stacking. And so we have, because of partisan sorting in the United States, because people are basically taking their political party and their ideology and everything about their identity is kind of matching on to one, like whether you drive a pickup or a Prius, whether you're rural or urban, high educated or low education, older or younger, religious or irreligious or evangelical or secular, you're figuring out where do people like us vote and belong. And so what's happening is you get what Liliana Mason calls identity stacking. And so all of these things become bound together, like your social identity. So it's really difficult for Americans as America secularizes slowly, and that's undeniable. So America has been secularizing slowly. America is also becoming more diverse racially and religiously. And at the same time, you've got the Republican Party becoming more ideologically pure, more disproportionately white, and more disproportionately conservative Christian. So all of those things are getting wrapped up together. So in a very real sense, these Americans who buy into what we call white Christian nationalism are very much under the impression that people like them are under attack, that they are being persecuted and targeted. That their culture, and this is the language that they would use. Trump used this and others used this as well, that where is our country going? And our way of life is under attack. And America as we know it is under attack and under siege in this kind of language. It's culture war language, but what they're talking about is there's so much, it's not just religion, but it's also our culture. It's also our ethnic heritage in a way, and our morals and our traditions. And in some ways, they're right, honestly. Like, America is changing, and a lot of the things that we took as normal or standard are being challenged because America is diversifying. And you could make the argument that America is becoming more like what it always espoused itself to be, a country that is where we value full legal equality under the law and representative democracy, and everybody gets a say in our republic. And so they're coming to terms with this fact that America as they know it is changing, and they don't like that. And the thing they don't like the most is that their own position and their own preferences in our society are being exchanged for others. And so that's a really tough thing to grapple with.
Yeah, and you know, we see that. I'm sure that you followed this a little bit, but you know, we have this thing in Washington called the People's Convoy. where a bunch of truckers got together and they're stationed outside of Washington. Actually, they're just leaving. And for the past 3 or 4 weeks, they've been trying to mess up traffic and protest. But when they talk about what they're interested in, their issues are all over the board. You know, it started as an anti-vaccine campaign, but they embraced a lot of the Trump stuff, and they all seem to embrace the whole QAnon conspiracy theory stuff. And it just seems so strange that it's really not about any particular principle as much as it is about them, you know, and the, and their particular status and what's happened. It just amazes me. Well, let me ask you, since you've consulted with the members of Congress that are studying the insurrection that happened on January 6th, did Christian nationalists play a big role in that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, I think it would be inappropriate to say Christian nationalism explains it all, right? Like, there's a lot of factors, and people had their own reasons. But it was clear that Christian nationalism was on display at the Capitol. Like, it's inarguable. I mean, you saw amidst all of the chaotic violence that we saw that day, we saw Jesus Save signs and Christian flags and Christian T-shirts, and we saw impromptu worship sessions on the on the grounds and throughout. And then there's this prayer in Jesus's name on the Senate chamber after the rioters had broken through and taken control of the chamber. If you look at collections of quotes from those who stormed the Capitol, it's that same kind of rhetoric that America was going to be reborn, that this was a Christian nation, that they were wanting to pray God's blood or Jesus's blood over the Capitol. And the testimony of Officer Hodge, this famous officer who was videotaped being punched in the face and squashed in between a door and screaming, his testimony said, you know, like, the people who assaulted me were definitely thought themselves Christians. I mean, he lists all of the things that he saw. And so white Christian nationalism was very much on display at the Capitol. What we've been talking about over the last, year or so since that event happened, we've been collecting survey data, and we have found that white Christian nationalist ideology, as we try to measure it, is strongly associated with the kinds of things that we witnessed at the Capitol and the kinds of things that we believe influenced what took place on January 6th. For example, we've already talked about this a second, belief in conspiracy theories. We find that the more white Americans subscribe to Christian nationalist ideology, The fact that they believe the election was stolen is almost 100%. It's well over 90%. At those who score at the highest percentile of our scale, they convinced that the election was stolen. They are also more likely to believe in QAnon conspiracy, I'm talking about the wacky parts of it, like the elite media, financial worlds, and politics are run by a ring of child sex traffickers, right? Like that kind of insane belief is actually really prominently present among people who subscribe to Christian nationalist ideology. Other things that like Antifa and Black Lives Matter were the ones who started the violence, or that even regarding COVID, that COVID vaccines are killing people, and that the COVID vaccines aren't actually safe or effective at all, right? Like these kinds, or the government's hiding everything it knows about the origins of COVID. So the more white Americans subscribe to Christian nationalism, the more likely they're going to buy into the really dangerous kinds of conspiracy theories. But on top of that, we find white Christian nationalism is associated with support for authoritarian violence. That is, like, violence as a means of accomplishing some kind of righteous goal, or what goal you perceive to be righteous. So we found, for example, in the report we just filed, white Christian nationalism is strongly associated with the belief that things have gotten so far off track in this country that true American patriots may have to resort to physical violence in order to save the country. I mean, that really is something that they are affirming. Lastly, we find that white Christian nationalism is fundamentally anti-democratic. It's not about increasing access to the vote or increasing access to participation in democracy, it actually favors strongly measures or policies that would limit access to the vote. So taking all of this stuff together, it seems clear that the kind of thing that we saw on January 6th is really indicative of a broader and more pervasive ideology that is anti-democratic. I think violence as a means of accomplishing goals, and particularly paranoid and prone to conspiracy theory. That is certainly what we were seeing on display January 6th, combined with, of course, like very vitriolic rhetoric from Trump and the right circumstances of a mob crowd.
Well, you know, first of all, I got to tell you, we had a professor from the University of Maryland who studies revolutions that was at the January 6th thing. And he not only went to the Capitol, but he was at the rally beforehand. And he said the thing that really struck him is that he's gone to so many demonstrations in Washington, but in this demonstration, he saw a disproportionate amount of middle class and upper middle class white people. He said there were people that went to the Capitol and rioted, and then he would see them later at the Marriott having cocktails on the veranda. And you know, and he said it just blew him away that there were so many, you know, because he was used to seeing young people, disenfranchised people, people of color, you know, and he said none of that. It looked like, you know, if they told you it was an ARP convention, you would believe it. So where is the energy coming for this movement? Is it old white people whose status has been reduced, or are there young people involved? Where's the energy for the growth of this movement coming from? Do you know?
Right. I think it's coming from across the spectrum. I don't see it localized within one particular age group. We don't see this like primarily among older or younger or that kind of thing. And as you were saying, like this, you know, what the professor witnessed, this being a middle class thing, I think that feeds into what we are trying to argue as well is we are scared that Americans are going to dismiss, as this goes further into the rearview mirror and we start to reinterpret things that have happened in America's history, oftentimes toward political ends, we reinterpret those things in ways that are convenient to our party or partisan interests. Yeah. As we start to reinterpret these things, I think Americans will be too quick to say that this is a fringe thing, that this is just 500 people who went crazy one day and it wasn't that bad anyways. But they, you know, they went too far, and I don't endorse that, but that is something that's fringe and marginal and would never happen again. And what we're trying to argue is that, like, these people came from just middle-class churches in Texas and all around the country. They went home to their communities where they have, you know, lawns that were mowed, and they have pastors that were preaching messages that were, that were probably middle-of-the-road evangelical fare. And they took that and applied it, and it became what we saw on January 6th. So the ideology of white Christian nationalism that we saw on display on January 6th, yes, that was an extreme example of what happened. I'm not saying that that happens every weekend or that could happen every weekend. But I do think the kinds of elements that we see mixed in, the ideological elements that contributed to what took place, are far more pervasive than we like to acknowledge, that we feel comfortable acknowledging. But I think it's right there in the survey data that a surprisingly large number of Americans, and white Americans in particular, buy into Christian nationalist ideology. And the more that they do, the more they are amenable to certain kinds of attitudes and behaviors that we feel like are anti-democratic and dangerous.
Well, you know, and I remember very distinctly seeing a special that was done by Hallmark 4 years ago about the situation in Skokie, where the American Nazi Party wanted to hold a rally in a city that was primarily where there were many Holocaust survivors. And remember the ACLU represented the Nazis. They represented the Nazis. They said, freedom of speech is freedom of speech. And the main character that was representing a group of Jews that were trying to resist this said, this is exactly what they said about Hitler, that it's a handful of people. He's crazy. It's nothing to worry about. You know,
right.
Nothing's going to happen. And, I really think it's something to worry about. But let me ask you again, I have another question from my co-host, who's a scientist. And she says, sure. Has your work looked at the biological component of violence? The work of many, and especially Dr. Jonathan Pincus, a Georgetown neurologist, shows that there are deeper underlying causes that conscious empathy and ethics are not inborn qualities, but are learned behaviors. In emotionally deprived children, Pincus's research shows that the brain development is permanently skewed by abusive upbringing. Impulses created by abuse are encoded in their brains when mental illness and neurology damage are added, which may cause exposure to drugs or alcohol or birth defects, any of these things. And her basic question is, do conditions exist that are quite likely to produce violent antisocial acts? And is that a biological thing? Is there a biological component? Has there been research that shows there's a biological component that makes these people more prone to violence?
So we do know, and this is, I think that's an astute question and one that needs to be answered. But I think what we are seeing, and this is research that has been done recently on tracking, say, young people who have grown into Americans who become more Christian nationalists over time. One of the things that say this is an author, Michael Rotolo, who is a graduate student at Notre Dame, and he was able to analyze this data that tracks Americans from the time that they are teenagers, early teens, all the way into their 20s. What he finds is that Americans who experience more authoritarian kinds of parenting and in some ways traumatic events are more likely to grow into Christian nationalism. So I'll just read you part of this abstract says, and he's got a lot of different data sources, but he says the author identifies distinct traumatic upbringing experiences among respondents, which conditioned heightened rage and fear affective systems. And this gives Christian nationalists an enduring sense that their way of life is under attack and motivates reactionary socio-political attitudes. So I think that's hitting pretty close to what your co-host is asking about. I think this author, at least in his social science research, and this is an award-winning article that he published, is finding that younger Americans who I think are exposed to the kind of upbringing that you are going to see, say, more authoritarian forms of discipline, witness outcomes that would lead one to, and this is this should be unsurprising to anybody who's familiar with research on abusers as they get older. They themselves were abused younger, right. And this shapes their expectations for how relationships go and for what how discipline is thought about and even their acceptability of like violence. I'm uncomfortable kind of talking about what's going on at the cognitive level. because that's just not what we're observing. We're not observing kind of brain functioning or fMRI scanners, but we are, in that paper, observing that there is a link between, say, earlier socialization and the kinds of outcomes that we see later on.
Yeah, that's something that's always amazed me, that abusers become abusers, because my father was physically abused as a child. He had a very violent dad, and he couldn't bring himself to be violent with us. He would do all sorts of discipline if we got out of hand, but he was, so I assumed that was the way most people felt, you know, that this was a horrible thing in my childhood and I'm not going to pass it on to my children. But certainly we see that's not true.
Right.
Let me ask you, you know, it's always been, again, I as a politician, I'm very interested in our culpability as liberals. You know, I remember going to a rally where they asked me to speak after Trump was elected, and some woman stood up and said, "As liberal Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for." And I was stunned by that. I said, "Of course we have something to apologize for. This man got elected, you know, and if people, you know, if we were doing such a great job as Democrats, right, he wouldn't have gotten elected." So what do you think our culpability is? And let me just add that ever since I've been in politics, 40 years, I think the Achilles heel of the liberal Democrats is that we talk down to people. You don't need a gun. You're just too damn stupid to realize it. And we're going to explain it to you. We're going to explain to you why you need a gun rather than sitting down and trying to talk to you about it. So what do you think capability is?
Yeah, that certainly plays into the narrative of, like, you know, the elites are our enemies. So the scientists and the academics and the media elite there and the establishment politicians there, they're out of touch and they don't understand what people like us need or want. And they are, against real Americans like us. I think along with that, I think Democrats need to be so wary of buying into the us versus them mentality that really only feeds the radicals. It only helps that extreme partisanship. That's not where Americans live. What's called a histogram chart of where most Americans on most issues end up congregating. Most Americans are not extreme, even in their political ideology. Most Americans are not like extremely liberal or extremely conservative. It is not what we call a bimodal distribution across political ideology. Most Americans are in the middle. They're kind of moderate. They're kind of maybe slightly liberal, slightly conservative. They don't like to see themselves as extreme radicals. Very few people do. But when we get into this us versus them, and when I say we, I'm an independent here in Norman, but I when I say we, I mean people who have a problem with this kind of ideology. So you've got Democrats. I think it hurts them to the extent that they buy into the us versus them mindset, and it causes them to basically play the same game that the extremists on the right do. And it's a game that only benefits them because it makes them feel persecuted. So when others on the right can, so on the far right, and I don't mean just like conservatives, slightly conservatives, I mean people on the far right. When people on the far right can point to quotes or survey statistics or little snippets of arguments from people that they can say, "Hey, look, these people hate us. And these people are out to get us, and they want to take away everything from us." I think giving them ammo doesn't really help the cause of one democracy at all, but also helping to bridge those kinds of divides. And I think it starts, and this is something that a lot of Americans don't understand. It really starts with the rhetoric of elites. As much as we like to think that, and by we I mean the American public who are not politicians. As much as we like to think that we can ride the wave of populist, grassroots mobilization to really cause some change, oftentimes the first people who move are the elites, and with their rhetoric, that's why we call them leaders. You know, they lead in the rhetoric and the kinds of things that they champion and get behind. And so, if you have elite politicians coming out and using really extremist rhetoric, that is so toxic. And so when the Democrats play into that game and start, you're able to get these kinds of sound bites that are able to be misconstrued or used as like, "Look how much they hate us. Look how much they hate the right. These are just leftist socialist, anti-American people." I think we end up undercutting the opportunity for real dialogue, and it just plays into the radical fringe.
Well, you know, Doctor, you just explained the basis of this show. We started this show. I started this show with a co-host who was a Republican, who is a woman who lives on the West Coast, and she left the show. She was on the show for 6 years, and now my new co-host is also she's a Republican. She was appointed by several Republicans. She's now an independent since Donald Trump, but you know, she's a Reagan appointee and a Bush appointee, a woman, you know, and that's the idea of the show, is that we're really closer in ideology in many respects than it looks, and we're trying to you know, show that by bringing a Republican and Democrat together, or an independent and a Democrat together. Let me ask you, again, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but how do we get from, I don't like the Democrats, I feel we're under attack. How do we get from that to actually being violent? Is there only a certain, is this just a fringe of people that are violent, or is the movement itself becoming more violent as a whole? We see people carrying guns in church. They bring guns to church.
Yeah, so we're going to see, I think we see more violence as violence becomes normalized, and as that rhetoric, and as people become radicalized and feel more and more under attack and persecuted. I think what took place on January 6th is a combination of ideology and the kind of ideology that I'm talking about today. But it is also, and I don't want to ignore this, it is also a function of what happens in mobs of people, right? Like, that is a sociological just
fact. Mob mentality. Like,
what takes place at football games? We scream and we rant and we say things to the ref that we would never say to them one on one, or want to be heard said, you know. And so when you are swept up in the euphoria of anger and righteous outrage, or what you perceive to be righteous outrage, and you see other people doing it, I mean, we are capable of horrible, horrible things. Now, the reason those people were there in the first place is because of what we have talked about thus far, right? Like, that kind of underlying ideology. And yet what can activate that ideology into mob violence is, I think angry rhetoric from an angry politician, and the perception that something has been stolen from you and that you are justified in doing whatever it takes to take back what is rightfully yours. So it's a combination of misinformation and conspiracy theory and mob violence, or mob mentality and anger, underlied by this idea that America is for people like us. When you think about what the QAnon shaman, I've said this so many times that it's almost memorized in my head, but when the QAnon shaman was praying that prayer on the Senate chamber, just the words that he was using, you know, he was thanking God for filling the chamber with patriots that love God and that love Jesus, and for allowing him and his accomplices to send a message to all the tyrants and the communists and the globalists that this is our nation, not theirs. And for allowing America to be reborn. I mean, think about that kind of ideology. What's buried in that rhetoric is an ideology that I'm talking about. So you've got both the combination of Christian nationalist ideology, but you've also got this kind of what happens to Christian nationalism when it's combined with mob violence and angry rhetoric.
And the mob, correct me if I'm wrong here, doctor, but the mob indemnifies me as an individual, right? It legitimizes what I'm doing. It allows me to put, you know, to put responsibility, you know, to disregard the responsibility I have as a person and put it off on the crowd. Does it not encourage me? And is there some critical mass that might be reached in this movement, as we've seen in fascist countries, for example, Italy,
yes,
or Germany,
right,
during the Second World War? Is that something we need to worry about?
Well, so I have two responses to that. So on the one hand, Christian nationalism as an ideology is declining as a percentage of the population. So we can see this in several different data sources, that it doesn't seem to be growing, even though there's two points in response to that. So Christian nationalism is is an ideology that's always there and latent in America's body politic and their popular consciousness, but it's also something that can be activated and stoked by the perceptions of threats toward white Americans, threats toward Christians, basically majority groups. And so even though we see it on the decline slightly, we could see it bounce back if the right amount of, you know, pressure or rhetoric or misinformation or kind of anxiety gets stoked. It can be said that even though Christian nationalism is declining, that could be used to radicalize, right? Like that kind of real perception that, hey, we are diminishing in numbers and we are under even more severe threat, right, could be used to stoke perceptions of persecution, of targeting, of discrimination. And that could be used to make more militant those populations or to radicalize. So I think the potential for, say, Trump rallies or something like that, those kinds of rallies where there's just angry rhetoric and there's promises to take the country back and to make America great again, and it's mixed in with all of this anti-immigrant, Islamophobic, anti-outsider kind of sentiment. I mean, I think that could bubble up and boil over to the kind of mob violence we saw at the Capitol.
And it's a very old political tactic. I mean, whatever your problems are, they're not the result of anything that you did. They're the result of somebody else. And, you know, one of my favorite political characters from history is a guy named Huey Long from Louisiana, who used to say, you know, there's 100,000 Frenchmen in New Orleans and your house could burn down and your baby could drown and not one of them would care, you know. And that was the rhetoric that raised him to the, you know, the position of the United States Senator. There's actually a statue to him. He was a very corrupt guy, but there's actually a statue to him in the United States Capitol. It's one of the Louisiana statues. Well, Doctor, we're running out of time here. We only have a few minutes left. So let me ask you, is there anything that you want to talk about, anything that you want to say that I haven't asked you that you think is important, especially when it comes, when is the flag and the cross? That hasn't been released yet, am I right?
It just got released today. So yeah, thank you for clarifying that. It actually, today it dropped officially. So it's available for purchase both in Kindle and as a hardback, and an audiobook should be available. That's in the works. So hopefully that'll be available soon.
Good. And if people want to reach out to you, is there a website or something that you want to give that where people can get more information or reach out to you in any way?
So they could either follow me on Twitter. So I'm at Soch of the Sacred. That's SOC. Of the Sacred, that's my Twitter handle, or they could just look me up at Samuel Perry, or they could email me at samperry@ou.edu, just my school email account. That would be the way.
Well, and you know what? I got to tell you, in doing research about you, we were stunned to find out how many Twitter followers you have. You have a ton of Twitter followers. So, what do you think about that? Does this help us that it seems, is it just because of your great looks and sterling personality, or is that are people getting more interested in this?
I think this is, let's just say a both and. No, I'm just kidding. I think it really is because we're trying to do the kind of work that people are interested in. My co-authors and I, the people who are collecting data and doing research on Christian nationalism and religion in American politics generally, are trying to do the kind of research that I think people are interested in and they frankly need to know about. One of the things that I'm committed to is I believe when social scientists stop talking about these issues in a public forum, there are other people who would gladly tell the whole world about all of these things, but often they're the kind of people that we don't want telling those people. So we want to do really good data-driven, honest research that informs the public, and hopefully my followers would agree that that's what's happening.
Well, I think your work is so important, Doctor, and I think you've been an amazing guest. And I hope as things proceed and you know, we can have you back again sometime so you can give us an update. And don't be surprised if you see me sitting in the back row of one of your classes where, you know, if I audit one of your classes, I'll be the guy in the back hiding so that the professor doesn't ask me any questions. That was a technique I developed when I was a college student. So continued success, Dr. Perry. Thanks so much for the important work that you do, and thanks for coming on our show today. We usually dedicate, at the end of the show, we always end it with a song that we dedicate to our guests. So here's a militant Christian song from the past, only slightly militant. Onward, Christian Soldiers. Thank you, Dr. Perry.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much. All right. Bye-bye, folks. We'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote.